Please be seated. The second case for oral argument this morning is Fred Soss, appellant, versus Rebecca Hine and others, appellees. For the appellant, we have Mr. Ronald Parsons, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Paul Lindy, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Gentlemen, if you weren't in the courtroom last hour, I did advise that our system there, the lights are not working, so orally I'll give you the two-minute notice, but the digital clock does work. So with that, Mr. Parsons, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes. Oh, yeah, and I should note for the record, excuse me, Mr. Parsons, that Justice Curran was called away due to a family illness, but she is listening to the oral arguments over the Internet and will fully participate. So the only thing she can't do is ask questions. With that, you may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court and my friend, Mr. Lindy. Margaret May Lee Soss was a remarkable woman. She was the Iowa State Spelling Bee champion. She was an award-winning farmer with her husband, school teacher for her entire career in our small country schoolhouses, married for more than 50 years, and when she passed away at the age of 102, she left 30 great-grandchildren. And no one who knew her and no one in this case disputes that Margaret was as sharp as a tack and fully competent until just 1 or 2 years before she died at age 102. And certainly when she executed the joint account and then later the power of attorney, and the power of attorney was in 2005. Just a few days shy of her 100th birthday, she went toe-to-toe with attorney Jack Thieler in a deposition and held her own, according to the record. My point here is that Margaret Soss was nobody's fool. This is a breach of fiduciary duty case, and Fred Soss, Margaret's son, and for the last 20 years of her life, her constant companion and best friend, stood accused of taking advantage of and basically stealing from his mom as he stepped up to take care of her during the last 20 or so years of her life. And whether there's been a breach of fiduciary duty is usually a jury question, and you have to live with what the jury rules. But we believe the issues in this appeal demonstrate that the terms of engagement here were not fair, that the law concerning the admission of evidence was not properly applied, and that this case should be sent back for a new and this time a fair trial. It's really kind of rare that I see a rule of evidence in black and white on the written page that was just flatly misapplied. Usually evidentiary rulings come on the fly during a trial, in the heat of the moment. But here, the written order of limine appealed from just incorrectly stated the law, and that infected the entire ability of the parties to present evidence in this case. The bright-line rule that this court adopted in Binash versus Moeller by its express terms only applies to oral extrinsic evidence to raise a factual issue on whether the grantor of a power of attorney intended to allow the grantee to use the POA, to use it to self-gift or self-deal. But the orders here expressly prohibited any extrinsic evidence of Margaret Soss's intent or wishes or actions, anything, to come into the record. And the trial court enforced that ruling at trial to apply it really to whether related to the POA or not, to the power of attorney or not. And I do want to make clear that, you know, we come here to praise the Binash decision, not to try to bury it. I think the Binash bright line rule makes perfect sense when it's applied in the context that I believe this court intended it to, where an interloper would ingratiate themselves to a vulnerable person, secure a power of attorney, and then use that power of attorney, for example, to change the beneficiary designation on CDs or bank accounts or investments or life insurance policies, or to change their will or to deed themselves property. And then attempts to introduce evidence saying, well, I only did that because even though the POA doesn't give me authorization, she or he verbally told me that they wanted me to do that. And I understand that when that happens, the temptation and the ability for perjury in those situations by someone who, to begin with, doesn't have ethics is great. So I understand that. But there's a big difference between a bright line drawn around those types of situations and a black hole that keeps expanding and swallowing up any evidence presented by a defendant about what the grantor ever intended, what were her longstanding practices, what were the arrangements, understandings that were in existence well before the POA was enacted and just continued unabated afterwards. And I don't believe Bynash was intended to banish the factual history from a case, in every case involving a durable power of attorney, or to cast a shadow over every relationship between a parent and child who desire to pool their resources and then affect the ability to do that through the legal vehicle of a POA. There really have to be thousands of powers of attorney out there in South Dakota, and many of them, like this one probably, were conferred before the Bynash Brightline rule was announced in 2006, and most likely don't have provisions specifically authorizing self-dealing. What happens? An elderly person will go and say, well, I want my son, my daughter to be able to handle my finances now. They'll go to their attorney. Attorney will pull it out of the files, the same or off the computer, the same one they've been using for 30 years. They'll execute it and never think twice about it again. But the execution of that document doesn't suddenly turn the child into a criminal or a thief or expose them to lawsuits when that which the parent always did and approved of and knew about beforehand just continues unabated. The piece of paper doesn't do that, I would suggest, and Bynash doesn't mean that. So there are three primary ways in which we believe the Bynash decision was fundamentally misapplied by the trial court here. It's a matter of law. First is evidence of the historical fact that Margaret, for decades, prior to the execution of this durable power of attorney, never charged Fred or Ben Zoss or Adolf Zoss or any of the other children she gifted land to, never charged them rent to farm the Zoss family land. That's not oral extrinsic evidence of her intent in creating the power of attorney. That's evidence of what her intent was in her arrangements with all of her children. And under the terms of Bynash, that's just not precluded. It's supremely relevant to whether or not a breach of fiduciary occurred when Fred didn't suddenly start paying rent when that document was executed, when he hadn't for decades. And as Chief Justice Gilbertson set forth in the Supreme Court versus Master Blaster decision, if evidence is relevant, it's presumed admissible unless specifically excluded. So we believe the exclusion of this evidence was just a flat misapplication of Bynash that severely prejudiced Fred because he couldn't explain. He wasn't allowed to explain to the jury, well, I didn't start paying rent in 2005 because it was never charged ever.
Now, in looking at the record, motion in limine, of course, is just a motion prior to trial. Was there an offer of, I tried to find an offer of proof and preserving the record. Was that made in this case?
Well, there were several objections that were sustained, but of course the law under Rule 103B now is that once a definitive ruling on the record is made prior to trial, as it was in this order in limine, you need not make an offer of proof or attempt to introduce the evidence at trial. And so you don't have to try to antagonize the judge and the jury by trying to keep getting in evidence he's already ruled pre-trial in a written order is not coming in. So that was not necessary. But we did several attempts where the judge even thought maybe something Margaret wanted might come into this trial. Objections were immediately sustained and witnesses were cut off.
All right. As a very close issue or corollary is the will, and was that ever, I couldn't find it in the record. Was that ever offered as, there was discussion about the will with quotes, but I don't see the will itself. Was that ever offered?
It was offered. It was an offer of proof made. I'm not sure whether it was included in the record, but prior to chambers or outside the presence of the jury in chambers, Judge Erickson said, go ahead and make your offer of proof regarding the will. And Attorney Larson at that time, representing Fred Zoss, made the offer of proof. I'm not sure whether the clerk included it in the record. I guess I don't know. I presume not. The will was offered as evidence of her intent.
But we don't have it to look at.
We don't have it to look at. I don't think there's any dispute about the provision, and we have an oral representation in front of all parties and the judge as to what it would have provided. So I think that's a sufficient offer of proof. Judge Erickson at the new trial hearing said there was no offer of proof, but he was mistaken about that. There was in chambers that said what the evidence would have shown.
But back to the back to the practices, what you call practices. You know, is the order in limine really that clear that it would prohibit historical practice? I mean, it says extrinsic evidence regard Zoss's intent to allow Fred to self-deal. Now, it seems to me the judge should have been told, we're not going to offer it for that purpose. We're going to show the history of what's gone on here.
Well, and I think that's exactly the argument that was made at the motion in limine hearing.
But I'm saying, you know you've lost that unless you, if that order is, that in limine order is not clear, you've lost the right to stand in that objection unless you made another proffer or offer at the trial. And that's what's bothering me about this.
Well, I think that did happen. There were several times Ben tried to testify about it, and his objections were sustained. And they're told they can't, you better not bring up that you didn't pay rent. I mean, there were several discussions about what can't come in, and Judge Erickson saying, that comes up, I'm going to grant a mistrial. So these witnesses were muzzled and afraid to even bring up anything that happened before the durable power of attorney if it related to her intent. They weren't even allowed to say, my goodness, she wanted to remain on the farm, and that's why we had these arrangements, because she didn't want to go into a nursing home.
That may have happened as a result of an objection, but my question is, did you then say, well, we want to make an offer of proof on this, exactly what our evidence would be?
I think we did. I think the objections that were overruled, the attempts to introduce evidence, I think there are enough examples of that go to this. And this is exactly what was argued and told. The Judge Erickson said in his oral ruling, which is part of his written order, that's not coming in. No evidence of this is coming in. I do think the record is preserved. And I think 103B is very broad in making clear that you don't have to keep antagonizing the judge and the jury. It says, really, that you don't need to make an offer of proof where there's a definitive ruling, and the definitive ruling was enforced in that fashion, I think, Your Honor. Really, if you look on page 30 of their brief, what the plaintiffs are actually arguing is they say the power of attorney created a duty to pay rent, even if Margaret Zoss didn't want to charge rent. I mean, that can't be what a power of attorney does. I mean, a power of attorney can't create a financial obligation that didn't exist already and that wasn't being enforced already. And so that's where I think this case needs clarification.
Well, was your client, was the lease, was that being accomplished through the utilization of the power of attorney, the continuation of the leases?
That's our other point, no. Every case that this court has held and all the cases this court relied on in the Bynash decision and the Stutt decision dealt with the use of a power of attorney to alter something.
Okay, but the power of attorney is very broad on leasing land and so forth. It just doesn't include the paragraph on self-dealing.
Right.
And it certainly could have been when it was drafted. Could it not?
It could have been, yes. But the Bynash decision and all the decisions talk about using the power of attorney. And you can't use an oral extrinsic evidence to then contradict and say that justified me to use the power of attorney in this way. Bynash was changing bank accounts and CDs, and Stutt was changing beneficiary status on CDs, and the Nebraska case was changing beneficiary designations, and the Hawaii case was making gifts of real estate, and the Prefke case from Wisconsin was designating themselves as the beneficiary of annuity contracts. Here, just the same thing that always happened continued to happen, and the piece of paper executed, surely it was not Margaret's intent to say, you know, by executing that power of attorney, I suddenly have tricked Fred. I've never charged rent for all these years, but when I pass away, now his sisters are going to get a windfall because I tricked him there. That wasn't her intent.
All right. The other, there's two parts to the verdict. One part was the verdict involving the sisters on land that they acquired through life, termination of a life estate. As I understand it, that part of the judgment is not being appealed. Is that correct?
Well, it's been appealed, but I agree there's a separation in the analysis there. Our argument is that these evidentiary rulings tainted the view of Fred. He wasn't allowed to explain himself, essentially. He wasn't allowed to explain his actions. And I believe that tainted the entire verdict. This was a very inflammatory trial, and this jury was inflamed against Fred, and he was prevented from explaining why he did what he did or didn't do what he didn't do, we contend. But I acknowledge, Your Honor, that there is a separation between the damages that are related to the breach of fiduciary duty and the breach of contract damages for the year which Fred farmed the land after his mother passed. There's an analytical distinction there. But we're asking the court to reverse the whole thing. In related specifically then to the practice that they shared their finances and that her food and heat and fuel was all bought by Fred, and he would use her Social Security checks to help do that and made transfers. Our point on that is that Bynash applies to durable power of attorneys, and we have a statutory regime regarding joint accounts. And Bynash doesn't say you can't introduce extrinsic evidence or even oral extrinsic evidence regarding why someone created a joint bank account. And in fact, the statutes, if you're looking at the powers under a joint bank account, require an examination of the evidence, and they don't preclude extrinsic evidence. I mean, there's rarely any other evidence other than extrinsic evidence. So we believe Bynash, by its own terms, doesn't apply to their long understanding that they would pool their resources and pay bills from the same funds after they pooled them. They're shared expenses. They live together. So we don't believe Bynash even applies to that situation. And that's what the Wisconsin Supreme Court did in Russ, and they distinguished Prafke, which this court relied on in Bynash, and said this is different. When there's a joint bank account, you can introduce evidence, extrinsic evidence, and even oral extrinsic evidence about the grantor's intent in creating a joint bank account with her son or her daughter or his daughter. And they did it because we wanted to pool our expenses, and I wanted him to take care of me. I didn't want to have to worry about writing checks into my 90s. And that's, at the end of the Russ decision, the trial court in that case relied on that evidence and saying there was no breach of fiduciary duty. So I think that is a line that this court could also, and I believe, should consider drawing around the Bynash decision. I think it should only apply to, as it says, and it should be clarified, that this court meant that it applied to powers of attorney, durable powers of attorney, but you can introduce evidence, including oral extrinsic evidence, regarding the reasons the court did other things, or the grantor did other things, like creating a joint bank account. And I also think that it has to be recognized that patterns of things, history, is not included in the Bynash prohibition. And I also believe that it should be clarified that it applies to using the power of attorney to do something, which the only way this power of attorney was ever used was to make a medical decision. Otherwise, it sat in a drawer. Mr. Zoss knew about it, but he never used it. He never changed anything. He never tried to change the will that gave a lion's share of things to the sisters, actually. They got a lot of land under her will, and Goldie was made the special representative long before the rift in the family, and Fred never tried to change that. He never tried to take advantage of anything.
Just
didn't keep paying rent. I mean, he kept not paying rent that was never charged, and that was the deal for all of the kids. In terms of the will, I do want to say just finally that there was the suggestion at trial that this was an affirmative defense, but this was evidence, documentary evidence, again, which doesn't fall under the Bynash prohibition, the bright line, documentary evidence that she did not intend that her children owe debts to the estate, and it was admitted at trial that these were claimed as debts to the estate. So we ask this court, we're not asking this court to make any judgments on what happened, what was appropriate. We're asking this court simply to send it back for a fresh look under a fair playing field where we can explain these actions, where otherwise we had to sit there under the enforced regime of a ruling that didn't allow us to tell our side of the story.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Lind, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Police Court, Mr. Parsons. Your Honor, it's my honor to be here today to represent Rebecca Hine, Goldie Burnham, and the estate of Margaret Zoss. This is a concerning case for this court. It's a case of elder abuse. Elder abuse can take place in many ways. In this way, it took place as financial abuse visited upon Margaret Zoss by her son, Fred Zoss. And how did this occur? It occurred when he was a fiduciary under a power of attorney for his mother. And I think if we look back at the facts of this case and get some background, we'll understand what happened here. Margaret Zoss was born in 1910. She lived out in rural Forestburg. She was married to Adolf. They were married, and she lived with Adolf until he died when she was 79. That would have been in 1989. They had five children together. My two clients are the two sisters. Fred is one of the three brothers. In 1993, Fred was teaching in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And while he was teaching, he was going through his divorce with his first wife. At that point in time, he made the decision to move in with his mother and live at the farm. He then continued to live with his mother until she passed away on January 5th, 2013. In 2004, Fred became a joint owner with his mother on an account at the First National Bank in Woonsocket. In 2005, October 25, 2005, his mother executed a power of attorney. That power of attorney was actually drafted by Fred's trial counsel, who is not his appellate counsel here. When that power of attorney was drafted, it contained specific provisions. It was not an off-the-shelf power of attorney. It contains a specific provision in that power of attorney. There were parcels of property laid out in the power of attorney, and Fred was given specific power to lease or sell that property. He also made sure that it was recorded at the Register of Deeds, because we had the Register of Deeds testify in this case, and she believed that it was Fred who recorded that power of attorney the same day that it was executed. Over this whole time, even though Fred's trial counsel was the person that drafted this document, it was never changed or altered to allow what Fred was doing. Instead, it just continued, and it did not contain a gifting clause, and it did not contain a clause that would allow self-dealing. After Margaret passed away, she passed away in January of 2013, Goldie was named as the personal representative of the estate. Goldie undertook an investigation into the financial resources of her mother. At that point in time, she found out and went and looked and went back to 2007, because that's all the available bank records there were. And what she found out was that Fred was engaging in this pattern practice of basically randomly, through electronic funds transfers, pulling money out of his mother's joint account, and then he was depositing it into his farm account, thereby commingling the funds. What she found out is he had funneled over $136,000 from this account into his farm account. She also discovered that he hadn't paid any rent for the land at any point in time, except in the last 2 years. But the problem with the rent payment in the last 2 years was that when Fred would pay that rent, and so the court knows, and I think it's clear from the briefs and from the argument and the trial, he paid that rent in those years because his mother was on the deathbed, on her deathbed, and he wanted to preserve the right to farm that land for one more year. And I think he believed that he had preserved that right, and after Goldie and Rebecca took over both the tillable quarter and the 240 in pasture land, they didn't get paid any rent that year and actually were asked by Fred's council to pay money so they could use that land. Because I think he had thought this whole scheme had allowed him to somehow continue to use his mother's land rent-free. But actually what he did is when he paid that money into her account, he paid $19,000 in 2011 when she was ill, and then he paid approximately $23,000 end of 2012 near her deathbed. He pulled both of those sums out almost immediately thereafter and put it back into the farm account. In addition, I want to address the issues here. First, these are evidentiary issues, and this court is on an abuse of discretion standard. And I think Justice Severson pointed something out. Even though there was a motion in limine on file and there was an ultimate order, it's never quite clear in the record what this pattern or practice is. We're never given what exactly the pattern or practice was. What was he going to do? Well, if he was going to have his brother Ben and Fred come into court and testify and say, well, there was a practice that my mom didn't want to charge us rent because we are family. How is that not oral extrinsic evidence under Benash? Isn't that what we're trying to prevent? We're trying to have a bright line rule to say, when you come to court, it better be in the power of attorney because you're not going to have witnesses here who are going to contradict the clear intent of the power of attorney. And it's quite ironic that Fred's trial counsel drafted that power of attorney, listed specific powers of leasing farm property, and nowhere within that power of attorney was it listed that he could self-deal or he didn't have to pay rent. And I think this court in the Benash decision recognized that the bright line rule is easily accommodated. All that has to happen is you can take the power of attorney and alter the power of attorney to allow for these limited self-dealing acts, but they never did that. In regard to the joint account, and one more thing about the pattern and practices that I wanted to point out. If you're claiming that there's a pattern or practice, well, then everybody knows that this is happening if you're claiming pattern or practice evidence. Why don't you go in and put that pattern or practice into writing? And then if we look at this pattern or practice argument, what we're going to do is we're going to draw an exception to the bright line rule in Benash. So any crafty lawyer who is defending these fiduciary fraud cases is going to say, well, we just need to come up with a pattern or practice, and the bright line rule doesn't apply. The exception's going to eat the bright line rule if the pattern or practices are allowed. Now I want to move on to the joint accounts.
Are you saying pattern and practice is simply not relevant if a power of attorney's been executed?
I think if a power of attorney has been executed, Your Honor, and I'm not trying to be too lengthy on this answer, but if a power of attorney has been executed, that means that under the Dubendorfer decision, that person that is the attorney, in fact, automatically becomes a fiduciary as a matter of law. Under SDCL 55-22, they cannot use that property that is the property of their ward for their benefit. So whatever pattern or practice was in place under Benash, you better have that in writing because you just took on fiduciary duties that you have to follow. And that's the situation here. Whatever your mom may have wanted before, the terrain just changed and you've now become a fiduciary.
But what about the explanation for what you were doing before the power of attorney was executed?
Well, one thing, Your Honor, and that comes back to Justice Severson's question. We don't know why that was happening. I mean, Fred was arguably in a confidential position with his mother long before that power of attorney. We don't know why he wasn't paying rent. I mean, my understanding, there were rent payments sometimes before. We don't have any evidence to look at. I mean, the trial court wasn't given anything as to what this pattern or practice was. The record's devoid of any pattern or practice evidence.
Was there any relevance of the pattern and practice to the period of time prior to the execution of the power of attorney. And what I'm really getting at is, in the damages, were there damages for amounts due prior to the date of the power of attorney, or was that all subsequent to the date of the power of attorney?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that all of the rental damages were calculated and the final argument was based upon the years 2006 forward. The power of attorney would have been executed October 25th, I believe, 2005. So it would all have been rent, pasture rent, and tillable land rent thereafter. I think that answers the question, but I don't think it would have mattered before because I don't think any damages were sought for that time before the power of attorney. But I do want to be able to talk a little bit about this joint account issue that's raised. One of the things that's very unusual here is Fred held a power of attorney with his mother, but he also had a joint account. And if you look at this, it's actually pretty telling of what the problem is. If I'm put on a joint account with my mother and I'm to pay her expenses, why don't I just write a check and pay for the specific expenses as they come due? It makes no sense for me to willy-nilly go into her account on a computer, and the testimony was undisputed at trial, and it was from Fred himself, that she couldn't run a computer. Why would I go into a computer and willy-nilly make various transfers out of her account for certain sums? It varied. I would just deplete her account as I need it. And then if I paid her rent, I would take that out at certain times. Fred was given ample opportunity at trial to explain what he used this money for. And let me step back 1 second. When he would remove that money, he was a fiduciary. Under SDCL 5529, when you commingle funds as a fiduciary, you have the burden to take the security of, or securely hold those funds. And when you securely hold someone's funds for someone, then you have to account back and tell them and explain what you spent those funds for. It's the same thing that a lawyer has to do when they do a recapitulation of a settlement. You have to explain how you spent that money. Fred didn't show up in court with any receipts. He didn't even show up with the funeral bills for his mom. What he showed up with were checks out of his account. Well, his whole scheme to transfer this money created a problem for Fred, because what he did is he commingled, and then he only had his own checks, so he couldn't show what he was spending on his mother, because she was paying her own Medicare sub. She was paying bills out of that account that came out automatically. I mean, certainly he bought things for his mother out of the farm account, but he took so much money out of this, and he could never explain where all of this money went.
And I may have just not read in enough detail. When you say commingled, Mrs. Soss's funds, Social Security, and so forth were going into this joint account. Were any of Fred's funds going into this account, or was she the... It's a question under joint tenancy, who donated or who put the money into the account?
I'm sorry, and I think I missed this when I was explaining it to the court. She did have money going into that account.
But did he? That's the question.
That's a good question, Your Honor. And it was very, other than his claimed rents, which came out in 2011, 2012, when he pulled out right away. And I believe earlier there was another rent he put in, and he pulled it out pretty quickly thereafter. I think that was 2009. He would put some money in there. But I think he put it more in there in the effort to keep it going so that the account wouldn't have overdrafts. I don't think he ever put a substantial amount in there. And at trial, he testified the funds that were hers in her account belonged to her, which is consistent with South Dakota law on joint accounts. And that somewhat leads me, answer the question? That leads me to the next argument. And I believe the appellant in his brief essentially argued that due to the fact that there was a joint account, that this somehow changes the landscape of Benash. And this was based upon the Wisconsin decision of Russ versus Russ. And I distinguished that in the brief, but I want to just explain it a little bit more and give an example. The Wisconsin statute basically says that during the lifetime of the joint tenants of a bank account. They own that together regardless of how much they contributed to that account. So let's say I have a joint account in Wisconsin. I live in Wisconsin with my mom. I put in $20,000, she puts in $80,000. There's a presumption of donative intent in Wisconsin that either I own the $100 or she owns the $100. We could own it both because there's donative intent. Let's say I own an account in Pierre, South Dakota with my mother in South Dakota. The law in South Dakota is different. The presumption in South Dakota is that if I put in $20,000 and my mom puts in $80,000, I own my proportion and my mom owns her proportion. And that statute is 29A6103, and it provides a joint account belongs during the lifetime of all parties to the parties in proportion to the net contributions by each to sums on deposit. In the Russ decision, the Wisconsin Supreme Court specifically considered that statute and used that statute to distinguish the earlier case, which established the bright line rule in Wisconsin. That decision, they're faced with a situation where the protected person had started a bank account with the attorney in fact. The attorney in fact then was taking money out, and after a conservator was appointed, he had to account and found out that he had taken more money than was spent on the protected person. The court, Wisconsin Supreme Court, in its decision, said, well, look, we have two presumptions. We have the presumption that we have an account and there's donative intent. So we know that the person, that the protected person probably could have given some of that money. But we also have the other presumption of fiduciary fraud because the person had a power of attorney. Under that situation, we're going to cancel out those presumptions and we're going to allow extrinsic evidence under the specific facts here. In South Dakota, there's simply no presumption. There's no presumption that Fred owned any of that money in Margaret's account. It's owned in proportion to the amount that you put in. And Fred even admitted this at trial. He said, the money that my mom put in there was my mom's money. So if you reread that Rust decision and you consider the presumptions, there's simply no presumption under South Dakota law while there's a presumption under Wisconsin law. The law in Wisconsin is simply different. One other thing I want to address, it's the will. And this was the 1989 will of Margaret Zoss. And to put this into perspective, Margaret Zoss, that would have been executed at the time of her husband's death. She probably thought she needed a new will. Margaret Zoss, 16 years later, executed a power of attorney. So to the extent that we're going to say that that's extrinsic evidence to clarify a power of attorney 16 years later, I don't understand how that's going to show some type of intent. But that's even beyond what the trial court was faced with at that point in time. If you look at the record, and I specifically laid out in the appellee's brief, the record portions where Fred's trial counsel put the personal representative back on the stand on the second day of trial.
2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. At that point in time, there were very specific questions over objection. The specific questions were essentially, you as the power of attorney, do you recognize that the rents owed your mother are a debt owed the estate? And over objection, Judge Erickson allowed the answer to come in. And the explanation by Fred's trial counsel was that it's foundation for an exhibit. Fred then testifies, and they have a hearing in chambers. Judge Erickson kind of shows his frustration that this is a last-minute thing, what's going on here. And it's pointed out why Fred wants to use this. It's because it has a debt forgiveness clause in the will. And never brought up before. Never pled as an affirmative defense, never brought up in the motion in limine hearing as some type of written evidence, and the Benash case was cited throughout motion in limine documents and at the hearing. So everybody knew that written evidence was a possible exception that this court hadn't considered. Judge Erickson simply considered that as what it was being offered for. At that point in time, it was being offered as an avoidance of a debt. Under Rule 8C, there are specific affirmative defenses you have to raise, but then you have to raise any avoidance of a debt. And if you don't raise those, they're waived. So the judge properly ruled that that would not come in. Secondly, I want to talk just 1 second about a case that I cited, Ward versus Lange, and I want to I cited it in the brief, but I cited it for a different proposition. I want to point this out to the court. I would request that the court review paragraph 21 through 23, which excluded a will. And the reason that they upheld the exclusion of that will was because the court at that point in time considered it to be an ambulatory document, and the person committing fiduciary fraud cannot rely on that. My time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lundy. Mr. Parsons, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Zinner, I wanted to go to your question about preserving the record first. On day two of the jury trial, pages 23 and 24, Fred attempts to explain why he didn't pay rent, and those objections were specifically sustained by the trial court. And on page 44 of the same volume, T2, question is asked of Ben Zoss. Ben, you were farmed some of your parents' land as well, did you not? Answer, I did. Question, did you very often pay rent? Mr. Fink, objection, Your Honor, relevance. Court sustained. Now, everyone knew that from the motion limine hearing where it was argued that the practice of not paying rent, not just by Fred, but by all the kids, would be offered, and that the court was enforcing its ruling to exclude that because the court considered that to be evidence of self-dealing or self-gifting. I think that was an erroneous ruling of law, but it's clear that that evidence was attempted to be introduced, and it was sustained. And Rule 103B says if there's a definitive ruling, you don't even need to make an offer of proof or attempt to introduce it, but they did here. I also do disagree with my friend's statements that the record is devoid of evidence of this. Not only was it argued at the motion hearing, all these points, except the will, I was not argued at the motion limine hearing, but the rent and the reason for the joint account and the sharing, that was all argued at the motion limine hearing, and the judge said it's not coming in. But the affidavits of Fred and Ben Zoss are in the record. They're in the appendix, and they provide the same evidence as what the evidence would have shown. All the kids knew that they weren't charged rent to Farm Zoss family land.
Appendix to the brief or appendix to what?
To our brief. Those affidavits
okay,
are
okay, that's not part of the record then.
Well, they're in the record. Yeah, they're from the record. They were submitted into the record. They weren't trial exhibits, but they were in the record for the court to consider as it was considering these motions. A lot of what we're hearing here are jury arguments. Now, there are explanations for what Mr. Lindy is saying. Our argument is that Fred was not allowed to give those explanations, and if the jury hears all this evidence and decides Fred is a crook, he just was stealing from his mom, he took her Social Security payments, and yeah, maybe he bought her food, but he was trying to enrich himself. We'll live with that if we get to tell our side of the story. And under Binash does not ban non-oral extrinsic evidence, like a pattern or practice. It doesn't apply. It was improperly excluded. Binash does not apply to bar evidence of a donor's intent in creating a joint bank account.
What non-oral extrinsic evidence would there be of practices? Fred's going to have to get up and say, I never paid. It's oral.
Well, I think that's a misconception about Binash, and the court will correct me if I'm wrong. But when the court says it's prohibiting oral extrinsic evidence, that doesn't mean there can't be any testimony about anything, in my view. What that means is you can't introduce evidence that the grantee or the grantor, I mean, in this case, Margaret, orally, verbally told me that I could do this, even though the power of attorney doesn't authorize it. That's how I read these cases and all these cases that Binash was based on. They prohibit you from saying, well, Margaret told me that I could use this power of attorney to change the will. That's the type of oral extrinsic evidence. The fact that, I mean, all testimony is oral, of course, but you can testify about things that are not oral extrinsic evidence. Like, Margaret never charged rent to any of her kids for 20 years and continued not to do so after this was executed. That's not oral extrinsic evidence, in my view. And I think all the cases that Binash relied upon would support that. And Binash also does not apply, my view, by its terms already, when a POA is not used. I mean, it only applies to oral extrinsic evidence that she said, I could use the POA to go do this, to change my will, to change your will, to change the designation on these CDs. That's what I believe Binash applies to. Courts are broadly, not just in this case, but broadly interpreting Binash to say nothing can, you know, almost as though it's strict liability. If you have a durable power of attorney, it's strict liability. Oh, there's the paper. No explanation. You can't tell why you did that. That's not what I believe this court meant.
So are you saying that we have to slice fiduciary duty, that you're a fiduciary in one part of the dealings with mother and you're not a fiduciary in other parts of it? How are we going to do that?
No. It doesn't have to do that at all. I'm just saying that the evidentiary field is different when you're not dealing with that. Fiduciary duties are still the same, but the evidentiary field and the ability to give an explanation is different.
So you're conceding that he is a fiduciary in every sense. After 2005, he was a fiduciary.
Yes, without question. He's a fiduciary. But that doesn't mean he breached his fiduciary duties, and those breaches caused damages by his actions. The jury has to decide that. And if he can't explain that I did this with relevant, admissible evidence not precluded by Binash, that's not fair. It's just not fair. Binash, in my view, doesn't apply when the POA is not used. It doesn't apply to activities, patterns, practices, and it doesn't apply to the intent in creating a joint bank account, the statutes regarding which require an examination of all the evidence. How could the statutes require an examination of the evidence of intent in creating a joint bank account, but then you can't introduce it? It just doesn't make sense. And that's what the Russ Supreme Court said. I mean, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said in Russ, I believe. The fact that the presumptions are different under the laws just means that's the evidentiary presumptions are different, but you still have to balance and weigh the evidence. The evidence still comes in.
I'm having some trouble also figuring out where I understand the argument on the land rent, but how does that apply to the bank account? Her money went into the bank account. If he's a fiduciary, doesn't he have to account?
Well, he has to account. The jury has to decide if he breached a fiduciary duty. And her intent in creating that joint bank account is relevant to whether or not he breached their arrangement. Her intent is relevant in establishing whether or not he breached fiduciary duties and what the damages that flow from that breach are. And that intent is not precluded under Binash. Binash only applies to intent in creating a durable power of attorney. That's our position, and I believe the cases support that. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court made clear to make that distinction based on statutes that create these evidentiary presumptions.
Okay, but again, going back to what evidence was there that he could apply funds for his own purposes out of that account? Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think he did apply funds for his own purposes out of those accounts. I think he paid their shared expenses out of those accounts, and that's what we attempted to prove at trial.
Well, how was that hampered by the judge's motion in limine?
Because he was not allowed to say, I mean, it was presented at trial as though Margaret was a fool and unaware, had no idea what was going on, while Fred is systematically stealing her Social Security money and her retirement funds and using them to get rich. And we put on evidence as to, you know, Fred had a lot more money than his mother did. I mean, he had money from multiple sources, but he used money from that account and went to Walmart with it, bought food, bought groceries, paid heating bills, paid other farm expenses, and she wanted to live on that land. She wanted to stay on her farm. They weren't allowed to say that. They weren't allowed to say, well, the reason we have a joint account, my mom set it up, is so she didn't want to write checks anymore. Her eyesight was not that good in 2005. It was failing. And she wanted me to handle all the money, didn't want to worry about it. She wanted to continue to get on the bus, go to town, and go to China painting class and go to teacher retirement meetings. So this was the arrangement we had, and the power of attorney never changed that arrangement. Now, I understand Binash would prohibit Fred from getting up and saying, my mom told me I could use the power of attorney to change her will to give it all to me. But Binash doesn't say you can't explain why a person, even using oral extrinsic evidence, why a person created a joint account. And we know why they created the joint account in almost every circumstance. It's for convenience. It doesn't presume that someone's a criminal and a fraud, and someone has to be able to explain that to the jury. When the evidence falls outside of the bright line, it's a bright line, but it's not a expanding, expansive thing that swallows up all the evidence. It's a bright line circled around a particular situation. And that's what we're asking this court to enforce, and we're asking this court to reverse and remand.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Court will be in recess.